Thank you, Ken. Those songs fit really nice with what I want to talk about tonight. And that is the idea of like fear. What should I not fear? What should I take seriously? In the Gospels, I'm impressed that Jesus would often tell his disciples, don't be afraid. And that is reassuring in the book of Luke chapter 5, verse 10. Do not fear, from now on you'll be catching men. In Luke chapter 12 and in verse 7. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, you're more valuable than many sparrows. I think the idea is you're not going to get lost. God's not going to lose track of you. You're not going to get lost in all the paperwork, so to speak, or the accounting and that sort of thing. God knows exactly who you are. God knows exactly what your needs are. God knows where you live. And God knows what you need. And God knows the things that are happening in your life. In John chapter 14 and verse 27, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful. I think it's interesting there that Jesus says, I offer a peace that the world can't provide for you. I was talking with someone recently, and the person had noted that they just have a number of friends, and the friends will often say, I just need a glass of wine as far as to relax. And she says, I don't understand that. How is that going to fix anything? But I think that's a good example of, that would be one type of peace that the world gives. And yet, in the book of Philippians, God says that he gives a peace that the world has a hard time understanding. The world has a hard time getting their minds around this peace that God gives. And not only that, but the world really has nothing to offer generally instead of that peace. It is a peace that surpasses all human attempts to equal it. It's not a peace you can get anywhere else in life. At the same time, though, Jesus noted that there are some things that we need to take seriously. I will warn you whom to fear. Fear the one who, after he is killed, has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I will tell you, fear him. But I like the way he starts that. He says, do not be afraid of those that kill the body, and after that have no more they can do to you. And the first time you read that as either a non-Christian or a new Christian, you're going like, well, that's quite a bit they can do to me, you know, killing me. I mean, and Jesus says, no, it's not much that they do to you. That's not much at all in the big scheme of things. Don't you realize that you're actually a soul or a spirit that just has a temporary body? That the removal of that body really is pretty small in the comparison of eternity. That's all they can touch about you. And it's almost like after that, they have zero influence on you forever. Maybe it's a little bit, remember when you went to high school, and in high school people were very concerned about who the popular kids were and things like that, different fads that went through high school. And adults tried to tell you, most of those kids you're never going to see the rest of your life. And so be careful about like following their lead, because this is such a small microcosm. The world is a lot bigger than this. Maybe we will understand that when we depart from this life, of how we are afraid of just all the wrong things at times and how little those things were in the big scheme of things. So Jesus is telling us that we need to avoid fearing the wrong things, end up missing what we really need to fear and respect. You know, it's so easy to spend our earthly existence concentrating on like the wrong thing, being into the wrong thing, being afraid of the wrong thing, excited about the wrong thing. I think of Proverbs 28:1, the wicked flee when no one's pursuing. And man, I don't want to be that person that's running like a chicken with its head cut off when there's really nothing to fear about, that there's nothing there. There's really nothing there. But you can spend your life fearing all the wrong or lesser things. We can be afraid of what people think. And that kept some people from becoming Christians and confessing Christ in John 12. And now those men are kicking themselves in eternity. Why was I all concerned about whether or not I was part of the synagogue? Why was that a big deal? Why was that the end all? Boy, was that small in the grand scheme of things. Why did I think that their opinion was so important that I had to lose my soul over it? Or losing some earthly position. The parents of the blind man were afraid of defending their son because they're afraid of losing some social status, maybe some economic benefit, or being preoccupied with food, clothing, and shelter. Matthew 6:32. The Gentiles eagerly seek those things. They're so concerned about, where's my next meal coming from? Do I have enough clothes to keep me warm? Do I have shelter? And so they're just really preoccupied with that. And Jesus says, God knows you need those things. But concentrate on seeking God and His kingdom first. And all of that will take care of itself. Centuries ago, Solomon said, here's where you need to start. And I always like when someone says, here's where you need to start. That really helps you waste time figuring out, well, where should I start? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. I like that. That is a healthy respect for God. That's the right place that you need to start. Have that in line. If you fear God, then that respect will put everything else, including all concerns, worries, fears, into the right categories. Isn't that one of the challenges of life? We got these categories. What do I put in which category? I mean, what's important, what's not important, what's eternal, what's temporary, what matters, what doesn't matter, what's right, what's wrong. I mean, what do I put in what category? And the Bible says if you have a healthy respect for God, that will automatically kind of click, and it will result in you will now know what goes in every category. You now will know what matters, what doesn't matter, what's important, what's not important, what's a matter of eternity, what's not a matter of eternity. You'll just kind of know what fits in all those categories so you don't end up emphasizing the wrong category and you don't end up sacrificing your soul for some wrong category. But if we ignore that, if we don't have a healthy respect for God, then we should not be shocked if we end up afraid of everything else. And with all sorts of phobias about things that really don't matter. So, what should I fear? One thing I thought about is, here's one thing to be afraid of, arrogance. That is, be afraid of thinking that you know all you need to know. that's something like, that's something to be afraid of. Here's just one more area that a relationship with God keeps you grounded, humble, because when knowledge is divorced from God, then you get arrogance. And I know, I think that's a good way to view it. That is, when knowledge is divorced from God, or when knowledge is divorced from God's truth, or when knowledge is divorced from faith, or when knowledge is divorced from agape love, what you get is arrogance, is the typical outcome. And here's one passage. Even though they knew God, Romans 1:21, they did not honor Him as God, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. The other thing, be afraid of having like the wrong goal or aim in life. You might say the wrong treasure. Because without a goal or aim, you cannot organize and understand all the facts around you. If you have no central goal and aim, and if it's not the right central goal and aim, it's like a compass. If the compass doesn't know where north is, the compass doesn't know anything else. You know, it's just kind of one of those things. And that's kind of what the aim is. The aim is like, your aim, the correct aim calibrates everything. Everything is calibrated correctly, so you know where everything else fits. Your aim should be that aim that can keep a group of people united and united over centuries. That's what your aim should be. And tonight we're meeting, and that is what our aim is, right? I mean, do we have an aim that can keep a group of people united, not for a year, not for 10 years, not for 100 years, but can keep a group of people united for 2,000 years? Yeah. That's the type of aim that we have as a Christian.
It's not something that you're going to go back and say, this was a fad back in 1980, or this was kind of a popular thing back in the 90s, or this was kind of an in thing back, but, you know, no one really talks about it much. We have an aim and a purpose that people can unite upon and that can keep people united for centuries. That's a really good aim. I like what someone said. Treat everyone you meet as if they were going to be dead by midnight. Oh, I think that's a great way to view people. How would you treat people? How kind would you be to them? How understanding? How merciful? How truthful would you be to them? How much would you make of every opportunity if you know that everyone you met would be dead? Everyone you met today would be dead by midnight. I mean that, and there's an element of, and you go like, well, they're not. You might say, well, they're not. Well, how do you know? I mean, life is pretty transient. And who knows what's going to happen? And for a while, a lot of times in our lives, it looks like everything's going fine, and then something just kind of out of the blue strikes, and it's like, whoa, that we're reminded of our mortality. And I like that. Maybe that kind of helps you as an aim in life. Everyone around you is a precious soul, and the clock is ticking upon everyone around us. And so let's treat everyone we meet as if this is their last day. Sometimes we talk about living each day as if it's our last day. But what about treating people like it might be their last day? Might be the last time we've met them. Have a chance to talk to them. Encourage them. Compliment them. Or etc. I think there was a... There are a number of couples sometimes. There are a number of couples sometimes that every time they part, they pray. Because they realize that's the last time they might see each other. Every time they part, they pray. And the last thing they want to remember is if something happens to the other, the last time we were together, we prayed. I mean, that's something that can help you through the life if something happens. So, tell me what you pay attention to, and I will tell you who you are. I like that. That is, tell me what your focus is. A person might say, tell me where you spend all your time, and I'll tell you who you are. Tell me what you put before anything else. Tell me what you work everything in your schedule around. I'll tell you who you are. And so I have that put in there because to me that fit the aim, the idea of an aim. Because what you pay attention to. Now we might say, well, my aim is serving God. But another person might say, I'm looking at you and you're not paying much attention to serving God. I mean, I see you paying attention to all sorts of other things. And I see other things taking precedence over serving God. So you ask me like, you might say, well, here's my aim. And I'm going like, no, the real question is, what are you paying attention to? Where's your focus? What consumes your time and effort? A relationship with God, among other things, helps us make sense of everything around us. And so there's a danger of, here's one thing I would be afraid of, is getting to the point where you doubt, not where you doubt. Doubts are good as far as got a question about that, not sure about that. And so let's get in, dig it out. Let's ask people advice about that, etc. This is the idea where you reach a point where you doubt everything, which I think is something to be afraid of. Because our trust in God, our faith in God, helps us put everything into the right categories, as we noted. That this matters, this does not, this is good, this is evil, this is eternal, that's temporary, this is worth my time and effort, this is not, this is valuable, this is junk, this is a waste of time. And our relationship with God should help us do that. And the Bible should help us do that. Here's something else that will, I think, help you do that. I was talking to someone a while back, and they received a really bad diagnosis. And they went through it and came out of it successfully. But they said once they got the bad diagnosis, they didn't want to watch TV anymore. I mean, all of a sudden that was junk to them. Like, with the valuable, precious time I have, I certainly don't want to spend that doing it. And so that's the other thing that can kind of help you, like maybe a crisis in your life or something that reminds you of your own mortality of, what am I doing? I mean, my time is limited and my time is precious.
And so what really, where do I really want to put my valuable, precious time? Yet without a relationship with God, without listening to the truth, then I will end up not knowing who I am, where I am, what life is all about, what is real, what is fake, and what matters and what does not matter. A number of times you'll go someplace. Washington Square has this. It has a map, right? It has a map, and a lot of places like have maps, and then there'll be this, typically it's a star. You are here. And I like that you are here because I'm looking at the map, but if I don't know where I'm at, that map doesn't help me if I don't know where I am in relation to the map. And I think that's maybe what we're trying to emphasize here, is that without God, without a relationship with God, without the Bible, you don't know where you're at on this map of life. In fact, the path that starts with doubting God or doubting the Bible, I never find ends there. Rather, one typically ends up doubting just about everything else, like in Romans 1. The individuals in Romans 1 who, I don't want to have God in my knowledge, I don't want to believe that anymore, I want to believe what I want, they rejected the truth about God. In the chapter, we end up with them confused about who God is, or what is God. They start worshiping idols. They end up confused about who they are, like the purpose of human sexuality and their own dignity and value. They get confused over that. They get confused over gender, and they get confused with just about everything else in Romans 1, 29 through 31. And when you read that list in Romans 1, 29 through 31, a number of thoughts are going through your head. Being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, gossip, slander, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, you know, you can't trust them, unloving, which means lacking a kind of a natural family love, lacking the love that a father should have for his children, or a mom should have for his children, or children should have their parents, that they're lacking that, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God, that is, they know exactly what the Bible says about these things, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, that's the ordinance of God, that is the consequences. They not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. And when you look at that, you're going like, first of all, I don't know if I want to have anyone like that as a friend. I mean, that's the first thing that jumps up. You also think like, anyone like that in your family would cause major drama. That wouldn't be any fun. I certainly don't want to marry anyone like that. Well, I don't want my kids marrying anyone like that. But you look at that and you go like, that's chaos. That's just sort of a chaotic human condition. And one letter said it's only one step from being completely confused to completely outraged, then to revenge. I thought that was a good observation. Because I think it's hard for a Christian to have revenge. Because we're not confused. No, it's hard for us to have a revenge in light of we know who God is, we know who we are, we've sinned. And so, man, how can I have revenge against somebody else when I've sinned as well? And not only that, but when I know what God will actually bring on people at the last day who are not right with Him, even my worst enemy, I don't want hell to... Even the worst enemy of the human race have no desire that hell hit him on the head. I mean, I would rather that they repent. And so I think that really helps us with things like revenge. We're very aware of our own sins, and not only that, but the punishment for evil is so great, greater than anything we would ever level, is it almost makes you have, it makes you have compassion on people that are lost. Like, man, I know what's out there and I know what they face and they don't know that. And so someone needs to help them. Someone needs to warm them. Added to all this, being confused about just about everything is not a good place to be because you can't start the race if you don't know where the race starts. Here's something else. Sometimes you don't know when the race has begun. Ecclesiastes 12:1.
Remember your creators in the days of your youth. But why? Because the race has already started.
I don't know about you, but sometimes we, as man people, we kind of get this idea like, well, when the race starts, I'll get in. Hello? The race has already started. I think a lot of people don't realize is that the race has been going on for some time, and you don't have this like, okay, I need to get ready to pop in. It's going. And that's why I think remember the Creator in the days of your youth, because the race has started before you realize it started. I like James 1:6. The one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. Which to me has the idea of, well, it indicates a lack of dependability. I don't know if you can count on someone that's like the surf of the sea. They're here, they're there, and they're not consistent, and they're not settled. And also, maybe the picture is kind of constant restlessness. Something else kind of not to, I would say, be afraid of this. Be afraid of being an easy target. When I don't respect God as I should, then I really make myself an easy target for Satan and the crafty people in this life. I've just been simply amazed at how being skeptical about God and the Bible results in being really gullible when it comes to accepting and embracing like the latest human fad. Ephesians 4:14 is a verse that I remember seeing this verse years ago when I was, probably read it when I was not even a Christian, and said, boom, been there, seen that. As a result, we are no longer to be children tossed here and there by waves, and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by the trickery of men, by craftiness, in deceitful scheming. There's a sense that the fair, I mean, I remember going to the fair as a kid, okay, and at the fair you got the rides. And, no, not for me. I'm not a Splash Mountain, Disneyland, the final thing, that's the limit on me. And so I'm not, hey, let's put you in the cage and whip you around so you get sick. No, I'm not. If other people like that, good. But the midway. Throwing darts at the balloon, pitching dimes and all the, you know, little cups and stuff like that. And the milk bottles, those whatever those things are, and the softball, and the big teddy bears and stuff like that, winning for your girlfriend. Life is kind of like that. Life is like a midway where you've got the carnies. You got the carnies there, hot with the white shirt and the white tie, wrinkled white shirt. And everyone's kind of like, hey, you know. And you go over there, and before you know it, you're like 20 bucks in the hole or whatever. There's an element that's kind of what life is like. And so Ephesians 4:14, I don't want to be carried about by every wind of doctrine, because when I look at that verse, I say, well, it sounds like that the people that are tossed here and there are really being like scammed by the trickery of men. And like I think Adam said in the class this morning, it seems that there are some people in life that like just come up with the next way that I can fleece somebody, or inventors of evil. And that's out there, and that's part of reality. I sometimes, of course, in selling stuff over the years, we've done a lot of Craigslist. And the scammers on Craigslist, to me, are pretty obvious. You know, I see what you list, you know, and I want to buy now. And I have secretary, and they will give cashier's check. And you know, go like, what are you talking, you know, you scammer. The other one that I've hit with a couple of times is, hey, I bought something, it was aluminum, and I saw that you listed this, and send me the Carfax. And that's also been a scam over the years.
Okay. When Paul warns Timothy about a time in which many members would no longer want the truth, he points out that such will result in members being easily misled. The time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but want to have their ears tickled. They will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires. But did you notice that? Okay, I want to have my ears tickled. I want to hear what sounds good. Okay, so what do I get? What do I get as a result of that? What's the payoff? They'll turn away their ears from the truth, and they'll turn aside to a myth. When I want my ears tickled, I'm saying, give me myth. Give me the myths out there. And then I want to close with this. Here's something else that I think would be one of those things like, you might, don't be concerned about this one. Don't make sure you don't end up here. In the book of Matthew chapter 12, it says in verse 43, now when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through waterless places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I'll return to my house from which I came. And when it comes, it finds it unoccupied, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and takes along with it seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. That is the way it will also be with this evil generation. All right, that scares you. So, to me, when I look at that last verse, and when I look at what it started with, because what this whole section starts with is the Pharisees and the scribes came up to Jesus and said, we want to see a sign. Well, he's already given them all sorts of signs, and that's in verse 38. He says, the only sign you're going to get, basically beyond the miracles I've worked already, is a sign of Jonah the prophet. That is my resurrection from the dead. Then he says this in 41 and 42. At the judgment, the men of Nineveh are going to get up and condemn you, people he's talking to, because Jonah preached to them, and they repented. The Son of God has preached to you with miracles, no repentance. Number two, the Queen of the South is going to stand up as well and put the finger at you, because she came from the ends of the world to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and God in the flesh is standing right here talking to you. That is that their repentance, their eagerness, their willingness to search for truth really exposes the lack of excuse that places like Capernaum had where Jesus settled and had opportunity to hear them. So here's a generation that heard the preaching of John the Baptist. Some of them had been baptized by John. Then they saw the miracles of Jesus and heard his preaching. Yet, what would they do with all of this? And to me, Jesus likens them to a swept house. You come in, house gets cleaned up a little bit, tidied up. Okay. It's swept. But there's a problem. Nobody occupies it. It's empty. It's a swept house, but it's an empty house. And then it says that the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. And that's also used in reference to when a Christian, when someone hears the gospel, becomes a Christian, and then they fall away. Same language is used. And so I think there's a parallel here that Jesus is giving to his generation. The last state is worse than the first. That is, you're going to do a lot of damage. You're going to cause people to stumble. You're going to cause people to ignore or discount the truth. And I think what he's telling his generation, you're no longer sinning in ignorance. You've heard John preach. You've heard me preach. You've seen my miracles. In rejecting me and John, you're no longer sinning out of ignorance. You have to harden your heart to resist me now. You have to deliberately close your ears and eyes to the truth. And so, when John first showed up, you guys had some problems, but you cleaned up your life for a little bit. But you did not bring in any goodness in the meantime. You didn't bring in any faithfulness. You didn't bring any spiritual growth in. You just kind of
you kind of put yourself in neutral for a little while. Yeah, you know, you got things together a little bit, but you just stop there. And I think the warning is that the other demons are going to show up because you have nothing to counter it now. Your life's cleaned up a little bit, but you haven't really embraced the truth. And I know that to me, maybe that's a good passage to warn people that, hey, I want to go to church, get my life kind of cleaned up a little bit. I don't want to go overboard. You know, I don't want to like become like fervent or anything like that. But, you know, just a little bit of help with this and this. And I think Jesus' generation was that way. Hey, just a little bit of help with this and this. I mean, not like I would ever die for him or something like that, or not that he would ever be number one, but a little bit of help with my marriage, a little bit of help here, a little bit of help there. And I think Jesus is warning them is that when you go that route, you actually end up being worse than you were before you hear the gospel. So, you know, because one example of that would be when you become a Christian, you know the system now. You know how it works. That is, you know, passages like Matthew 18. And here's what I've heard from a number of people over the years as far as someone that became a Christian, they fall away. The person who's fallen away has basically said to the people coming to try to bring them back, there's nothing you can tell me I haven't already heard. And there's an element of truth in that. They've already heard it. And it hasn't made an impact. And if you ever find yourself saying that, like, hey, I don't want to live the Christian life anymore, and leave me alone because there's nothing you can say that I've already heard, you can say, that sounds like that swept house guy. Sounds like you know, and it sounds like you're about ready to let the other demons in. And so, maybe avoid that. The context here is a clear warning against becoming a swept house and yet not adding anything good to your life after conversion. Not becoming a full house of goodness and righteousness. It's not enough simply to abstain from evil. You must pursue the good as well. It's not enough just to stop the works of the flesh. You need to add the fruit of the Spirit. Also a warning here against ignoring all the unresolved things, all the loose ends, all the unaddressed issues in your life, all the things that you don't talk about but need to talk about, address, own up to, and fix. That powder keg that's simmering under the surface. Yeah, need to address that. So, Jesus says, don't be afraid. Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. You know, fear not, fear not. You're more valuable than many sparrows. You're not some little spot in the universe. You're not some insignificant dot. You are not, I heard it the other day, you're not dust blowing in the wind. Oh, we are as dust blowing. No, that's not all you are. You are far more than just dust blowing in the wind. You're a man or woman created in God's image, and Jesus died for you. And make good use of that as we stand and sing.